Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening around the world simply without compromising on the details. Erdem Koch is my name, and I'm joined by my co-hosts Ozan Ibrahim and Rodney McCune. Gents, good to see you both again.
Great to see you.
Been an interesting week.
It has, and let's start in the Middle East, shall we, where Israeli troops have entered Lebanon in what the Israeli military calls a limited, localized, and targeted ground operation against Hezbollah. Now, when we're recording this, at the time of recording, rather, more than 1,000 people have been killed. Up to 1 million may now be displaced. And of course, it follows the killing of the Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah, earlier, which Israel said was a sort of a key target in this offensive. The Lebanese prime minister has said that they are now facing something unprecedented and increasingly worrying in the region. Rodney, let's start here. It's obviously a grim time for the world. You've worked with Middle Eastern governments before. How do you sort of see what's happening at the moment, the Israeli incursion into Lebanon? And I guess, where do things go? If you could sort of give us a bit of an overview of your thoughts.
Well, I mean, it's clearly a northern pivot by Israel in order to wind down what's happening in Gaza. I mean, domestically, the action already in the north against Hezbollah is more popular domestically than Netanyahu was experiencing from the, I'm going to call it a performance in terms of what was going on within Gaza, but obviously there's issues around hostages and other issues, and taking out Nasrallah was a popular act in terms of Israeli domestic opinion. So there's certainly a domestic component to it, but there's also a broader regional play that's been move forward or progress by Israel. They've been goading Iran for some time. You know, there's the helicopter incident in May. There was the consulate in Syria incident in April. And then there was the Hamas leader who was targeted by Israel in Tehran in July. And there's a broader testing of Iran by Israel. This is more than simply securing the northern border. This is something much more regional, in my view. And, you know, when Netanyahu spoke on Monday, he addressed the Iranian people. How many of them, given the media access, will actually hear that in Iran? I'm not sure. But it was set up as a very clear warning, but also a positioning where the Iranian people aren't the enemy of Israel. It's the regime, and it's the regime that's supporting Hezbollah. It's the regime that's supporting the Houthis in Yemen. And it's the regime which supports Hamas in Gaza and so on. So, you know, you'll not hear huge noise from the Gulf Arabs beyond the regular noise in terms of Palestine and Palestinian issues, because of course it's not unattractive for the Gulf Arabs to see Iran paired back within that region. Of course, anything that's limited, targeted, and localized will often not be that, and it's going to have civilian casualties, as all conflict does. And those are the real difficult and thorny issues which will potentially cause things to overplay in terms of Israel, or responses to be more significant in terms of what Iran may or may not do. But, you know, there's also the question of what can Iran do? What is the capacity of Hezbollah? How far are Israel prepared to go under Netanyahu? Probably further than many others. And, you know, what might seem like a smart play from Israel at the moment might prove to be a very poor decision in days, weeks, and months from now. So it's a very tense period. There's already been a lot of unnecessary loss of life in Gaza. Israel are moving north, as I said, a northern pivot. And the next hours and days, for those in southern Lebanon, many of whom have been displaced already, I think it's 1 million are said to have been displaced and moved north. Similar on the other side of the border, where people have been moving south to vacate the same region. I know that they say that they're looking at pushing Hezbollah back about 30 kilometers to what was in effect the 2006 UN resolution line. But again, targeted, localized, limited, those are quite confident, but often pretty simple labels to add to something which is obviously full on ground military incursion and conflict.
Ozan, when this, I guess, latest round started on October 7 with the Hamas attack in Israel and then the Israel assault on Gaza, I remember speaking to you when you saying, if this spreads to Hezbollah, things start to get very, very serious from a regional and potentially sort of world conflict perspective. How worried are you that this is not going to be limited, localized, and targeted, and that it will continue to spread?
You know, the terminology that Israel used is, I think, to the word identical to terminology that they used when they did the ground incursion into Gaza a number of months back. So I'm not sure that it will be what they claim to be. I think, you know, Hezbollah is not Hamas. Hezbollah is a much better trained, better equipped opponent. And I think this is going to be a very, very difficult thing for Israel to undertake without causing, if you ask me, mass destruction, and unfortunately causing or resulting in many civilian deaths, many more civilian deaths, which, you know, at a time when we should be talking about ceasefire, we should be talking about de-escalating, what's happened this morning has really escalated. And everybody who is an Iran watcher or a Middle East watcher, I think today is really, really worried. Now, the reality is Israel's calculus, I think, is that Iran is no longer in a position to be able to strike back without causing serious ramifications and or repercussions for itself. And I think they are relying on something and are confident that Iran's actions or Iran's response to this is not going to be catastrophic for them. You know, I wouldn't want to bet on that, because I think Iran has spent the last 15, 20 years building up a buffer against Israel's what they perceive to be aggression against itself through Hezbollah. And that buffer looks like it might get severely damaged over the next little while as the ground incursion continues. And that can't be all that good for Iran and the regime, because as Rodney touched on, Iran's problems, if you ask me, are as external as they are internal. They have serious domestic pressures. We saw over the last couple of years significant protests, significant civil unrest, a lot of social movements being activated, being energized against the regime. These are serious concerns for the regime, and if particularly to try and strengthen up their domestic support amongst their supporters, they need to do something. However, I think they're very limited in terms of what they can do. We saw in April when they responded against Israel's attack on its diplomatic mission in Singapore, in Syria, that that attack was quite half-hearted and, you know, was very easily knocked back by all of the allies, the UK, the US, and Israel. You know, just geographically speaking, Iran's ability to reach Israel is quite limited, given their proximity and given their distance. So they rely on their proxies, and one of their proxies is under serious, serious threat. And I think their hands are tied. There's not a lot they can do without pulling in other countries into this. And I'm not sure they're going to come out on top if they start to pull in the US and other allies into a wider regional conflict.
Well, in so many ways, they already are. I mean, the US is sending an extra aircraft carrier with more troops to the region, which is basically designed as a deterrent against Iran. So it's almost a question of what the Iranian response is. Do they wait? Do they go? But Rodney, you're about to say something. I spoke over you there, mate.
No. Ozan's bang on with the missile barrage and drone barrage in April. And to be honest, it had a feeling of choreography about it. that it would play out in a certain way, that, you know, everyone could be seen to be doing something without it being so catastrophic that that it would trigger something further and bigger. It was an off-ramp in a sense for everyone concerned. But Israel now, having taken the action that they've taken through these, you know, pagers and then the walkie-talkies, to really degrade the capacity of Hezbollah, and then, you know, targeting leadership and so on, there's a potential that one, Israel has miscalculated, and that there is some significant response. But there's also the possibility that they have degraded Hezbollah to an extent where they can pursue military outcomes in a way maybe they wouldn't have been able to do previously, or haven't done, certainly for a significant period of time. But then the question is, what's going to limit the furtherance of that? You know, where are the off-ramps here? There could be a temptation to, you know, for both key players in this, Iran and Israel, to go much further than either had anticipated they would when they made their initial calculations. And that's why there's a high degree of risk attached to all aspects of this, and notwithstanding the obvious civilian casualties that are likely to come from this, there's another game being played out here, and it's one that has a high degree of risk attached to.
Well, I think the problem is no one can really say where this is saying where this is heading, right? And that is such a dangerous sort of thing. I mean, is it, you know, does Israel get bogged down in Lebanon as it did between, you know, 1982 to the early 2000s? Is it really a miscalculation? Does Iran fire back? It feels like we're on the edge of something monumental in the world in a bad way, and not knowing where it's heading. I mean, beyond the incredible humanitarian disaster that we've already seen in Gaza for the past year and a bit, and you know, at least with the assault on Gaza, obviously what has been happening on the ground there for several decades now has been worrying many people. You know, this last year plus this sort of next chapter, I guess there's absolute room for anxiety and even fear about what this means for the region and the rest of the world. What do you guys think from a economic perspective? Does it have implications beyond the region? Like, does it mean anything for a global economy that feels like it's sort of starting to recover from the fragility that we've seen in the post-pandemic period?
Certainly, any regional conflict in that region is going to have a major impact on, you know, on oil and various other, well, the Yemen conflict has already had a significant impact on shipping routes and what have you. But I think, look, the timing of this also is not a coincidence, if you ask me. I think, you know, putting the economic side or the economic impact to one side, I think it's going to have a huge political impact, which is going to lead on to or translate into economic impact. I mean, as Rodney mentioned, we've seen the theater between Israel and Iran for the last 6-7 months. But I think, you know, we talk about off ramps. There is no real off ramp without some serious face losing or losing face on both sides here. We're talking about a Netanyahu who knows fully where the US is today, and that is, we have a lame duck president. We have an election in 4 or 5 weeks. On one side, you know, is a bloke that probably couldn't show you where any of these countries are on a map. On the other side is an untested candidate. You know, this is severely opportunistic from Netanyahu's end. And, you know, I think the political impact is going to severely translate into an economic impact. I think, you know, just as the world economy was starting to show signs of you know, bouncing back from last year, inflation is getting under control in many places. The last thing that the world economy needs is another supply side shock like we had during the pandemic. And, you know, the mother of all supply shocks could occur if suddenly there is a major, major conflict in that region.
Supply chain disruption, energy costs, pressures on the cost of living, which is already a factor right across the West, and indeed it was a pressure point in Japan as well. When obviously there's been a political developments and change there. So yes, there's always going to be that risk of further pressure being applied. But I do sense that, and I know that America has, the US has already come out and made its comments about this whole thing, but I do have a sense that the West aren't so concerned about someone applying political or military pressure on Iran, given their relationship with Russia and the other conflict going on in the Ukraine at the moment. And there's a possibility, and I'm going to say a fair possibility, that there's quite a few countries that are comfortable with Israel being the party that's applying that pressure to Iran at the minute. So yes, whilst you're here for calls for ceasefires and other things, that uncertainty in Iran and possibly for the regime there looking to domestically shore up what could be a its position in a regional conflict will certainly take its attention off how it cooperates with Russia in terms of what's going on in the Ukraine. So there's another dimension to this as well, outside the regional dimension, which is where the West really sits in relation to a lot of this.
And I think one of the things that, a few episodes back, we had Ali Vaez on, who is an expert on Iran. I was really quite interested in what he had to say around other countries such as Russia, China. And his view was clearly that they would sit it out. Now, that was a different world back then. And we're only talking 4 or 5 months ago. I'm not sure that's the case. I mean, I'd love to get Ali back on and get him to make the comments. But I think many of those countries, what is considered as Iran's allies in the past, China and Russia, etc., I'm pretty sure they're watching with great anxiety as well. And I'm worried that there might be some opportunistic moves by them to further pull in the US and its allies, and it become a bigger conflict than just the region. So, unfortunately, not a lot of great news this week.
Not from a regional or a humanitarian perspective, that is for sure. And I think it's devastating to see some of the images come out and what is happening. And we forget that in the grand scheme of things, it's the people on the ground that suffer the most. And it's I think all our hearts break when we see that. And so much of this is going to come down to domestic pressures as well as international pressures. And speaking of domestic pressures, well, a very interesting result earlier this week in Austria, heading over to Europe now. The far-right Freedom Party in that country has opened a new door in the country's politics in what was an unprecedented victory in the election. They won close to 30% of the vote. They will not be able to govern without a coalition, but it's certainly a new chapter in Austria's history. Rodney, was it a surprise that the Freedom Party got the vote that it did, especially in the context of the first round of the EU elections, where we saw, I guess, the rise of the far right in Europe?
So the polling in Austria over the past 2 years has really basically laid out that this was likely to be where things were going to end up. So if you've been following the polls, this certainly isn't a surprise outcome. This is a party which is very much on the on the far right. They've been involved in coalitions previously, but it's the first time that they've come out on top in an election with, outpolling this. I'm going to say the moderate right, ÖVP, who came in with about 26%, with the Freedom Party coming in on 29%. Now, the interesting angle in this, which is beyond just the Freedom Party itself, is the toxic label or perception from the establishment parties of their current leader. Now, he's someone who's previously been in government. He was the Interior Minister for 2 years, 17, I think, to 19, which was before the Ibiza scandal, which brought down 19 in 2019, brought down the government. Which was a covert recording of a meeting in 2017 where there was an exchange or purported to be an exchange of an offer for government contracts for favourable news coverage. And he, though it didn't involve him, He was then responsible for part of the investigation into this, and it wasn't considered particularly took it particularly seriously. And he then left office at that time and was considered to be particularly toxic. Now, his association with the far right in terms of identitarism, his stuff and rhetoric around immigrants is extremely strong. When he was minister, focused on deportations. He had used the police against the media. He had been criticised for restrictions on freedom of the press. He wanted to rename asylum centres as departure centres. He had talked about, during this campaign, concentrating asylum camps, which was, again, a particular choice of language around previous Austria-Germany far-right regime. And he had on many occasions called himself the People's Chancellor, which of course was a term associated with Hitler. So he plays very strongly to far-right rhetoric. He draws his hand back into the Second World War period of Austrian history. At a funeral last week of one of a former senior member of the Freedom Party, the SS anthem was played, and it had an attendee list of a number of current and former significant players within that party. So this is a very significantly far-right politician in Western Europe, distinct from Hungary, which of course fell within the Soviet sphere of influence in terms of his also pro-Russia position. So, you know, distinct from Orban, obviously congratulated by Orban and Wilders in Denmark. But we're not yet at a position where we know what way it's going to play out in coalition. During the election campaign, other parties had said no coalition with the Freedom Party if he's anywhere near a government ministry. So his dreams of being the People's Chancellor might go with that. There's a discussion around a grand coalition to exclude the Freedom Party on this occasion. But again, there'll be concerns about the longer you push them outside. Is the net result of that simply going to be an increased vote for them at a future poll rather than having them in government and not doing particularly well, and possibly that depressing their vote again? But it's the Freedom Party's leader, Herbert Kickl, who is the toxic individual who the other parties don't want anywhere near a government ministry. So if he holds out and his party holds out for him having to be in government and the senior partner in a coalition, well, then it's going to be a very interesting discussion over the next period of time. If the Freedom Party say, fine, he'll remain as the party leader, he'll not seek government ministry, then I suspect there's a potential from the Freedom Party being back in coalition with this centre-right party. But this is all going to be played out in discussions over the next period of time, and it'll be calculations on behalf of the Freedom Party if they want into government now, or they feel that they're better out for a longer period of time when they can position themselves again as anti-establishment and so on. So interesting period for Austria over the next few weeks. We know how often these coalitions can take some time to form, but I guess my sense will be that they will be in government rather than a grand coalition, and that the argument about keeping them out for longer will not win through. And I suspect the centre-right will do some sort of deal with them and find some grey area where they can maybe not have him as chancellor, but maybe he does return to government as in a ministerial position. But again, we'll see how that plays out over the coming days.
Yeah, the whole conversation around pushing them out is a really interesting one. I mean, the thing is, it's so consistent across what's happening in Europe, right? I mean, we see far-right parties already in government or or, you know, at least pushing at the gates in terms of getting a lot of policies across the line, especially around immigration. I mean, parties that are either classified as far right or national or, you know, conservative are already in ruling coalitions in Croatia, Czech Republic, in Hungary, in Italy, in the Netherlands. You know, in Sweden, we're seeing a far right party is propping up a minority government. In Germany, we're seeing sort of local elections being sort of dominated by the right. Ozan, what is it about where things are at in the world at the moment, do you think that we're seeing this rise, this tilt, if you like, to the beyond the center right to the far right in terms of the popularity of these parties popping up?
Well, there's populism, there's far right, and then there's Herbert Kickl. I mean, this guy's in really a league of his own. Austria has delivered once again for us. This person is being branded as People's Chancellor, as Rodney mentioned. He is a truly, truly toxic character. I think not to be surprised. I'm not, you know, what we're seeing in terms of the rise of populism, far-right ideology, etc. This is all, I think, to be expected because I think Europe has done a particularly bad job of dealing with migration inflows. And I think, you know, it's the lack of leadership in a lot of the leading European countries and allowing these issues to be become the top issues that people respond to when it comes to elections and the political discourse. I think that's a failure on behalf of European leadership. Now, I think probably one could say that Europe has been severely impacted by the migration, particularly over the last 10, 15 years, Syrian refugees and from other places that are war-torn, et cetera. But, you know, there's a way of dealing with these things and a way of kind of making it into a political football, which I think they've allowed this issue to become such a polarizing issue that this is not a surprise. But as I said, we need to be very specific about this. This is not Orban or Trump style populism and right wing rhetoric and kind of populist overtunes. This guy is a serious sympathizer of Nazism from what I can gather. And you know, he's talking about how he doesn't want to be a diverse country, and he's pushing for homogeneity rather than diversity. I mean, these are things that we shouldn't be hearing in 2024. And of course, he's bringing kind of the whole Islamization of the country. And, you know, you don't have to look very far from Austria to see that, you know, what's happening in France, certain parts of Germany, etc. Yes, there's some serious concern from Germans, French people, etc., around the lack of integration of new migrants. Many of these people fleeing horrific, horrific circumstances. And this is understandable. But, you know, as I said, it's a lack of leadership. It's a poor response to what has been a massively poor response to what has been a massive crisis in a humanitarian crisis over the last 10, 15 years because of all of the problems that we've faced, again, in the Middle East. Everything seems to lead back to the Middle East.
Well, as if the elections weren't enough across the course of 2024, Austria being the recent, one other country has unexpectedly snuck in, and that is Japan. The Japanese will head to the polls on October 27 after a snap election was called by the new Prime Minister, Shigeru Ishiba. Rodney, they snuck in just in time to make 2024 even more interesting.
The year of elections, and this one's one we weren't expecting. And, you know, when you look at leadership contenders this time around, you have a guy who has, as he said, he would call an early election. But, you know, it's his fifth time going for prime ministership. He had his first go, I think, in 2008. He went again in 12, 16, and maybe 20. Sat it out in 2021. Finally, at the age of 67, he was the oldest of the three candidates, secure a position as a prime minister, which is obviously a great personal achievement. But he's now found himself where, within a very short period, he's calling an election where the cost of living and the standing of the LDP with scandals and donations issues and so on have really caused him to drop in the polls. Now, he positioned himself outside. He's in the party, but outside the current leadership, because he wasn't a minister in the government prior to winning the leadership election. But he had served in maybe 07 or 08 as a defence minister and then the agriculture minister for two short periods. Perhaps at 67, he's not one for the future, but maybe in Japan, of all places, life expectancy such that maybe he is still considered to be a youthful candidate. But yeah, I mean, he's now going into an election, which is going to be a very difficult election for his party. He's popular within the party. He's he went for the leadership campaign. His leadership campaign was founded on revitalizing the economy, being competent for security within the region. Obviously, there's the issues of North Korea missile testing, and both they and China have had other incursions, and Russia and China, in fact, naval or sea incursions into territorial waters and so on. So there's a regional security issue. There's revitalizing the economy, and then there's cleaning up his own party, which is the other promise that he's made. But of course, we can see, if you look at the UK, the how Keir Starmer found that very type of pitch about cleaning up politics and service and so on came unstuck within a short period of time through political donations and other things. And, you know, Sheba might find that it's exactly the same for him. And that cleaning up the party might not be as easy a win as they'd like it to have been, especially when they're moving straight into an election campaign where any other baggage that happens to come out in terms of scandal or corruption and so on doesn't get attached to his predecessor, it gets attached to him. So this is going to be a difficult election. Again, cost of living becoming an issue. You know, you look, and we did touch on Austria, but, you know, you look at these issues around immigration, not an issue in Japan, of course. But you look at pressures on, because the economy can't support the level of public service that maybe people have previously experienced. And it does cause electors to look at alternatives, even if there were alternatives that they wouldn't have previously looked at. So it's a really interesting time in Japan. This has been, you know, quite a turnover of leaders in recent years. And I'm not sure that this chap will last that long either.
Ozan, can you win?
Well, I mean, the guy's certainly got some perseverance. So, I mean, of course, I think they're likely to win. I can't see the status quo changing. It's really around how many seats they lose. Their brand is severely damaged with all of the scandals that have been in the background, and you know, I think they've got a number of economic problems that are going to, as Rodney talked about, cost of living. But you know, you've had a weak yen for a long time, or a weakening yen. You've had a massive migration of manufacturing going out of Japan, and many of the companies who had manufacturing in Japan, particularly Japanese companies, etc., have been looking for a long time at getting out of Japan. You have had low interest rates for a very long time. You had deflation for a very long time. For the world's fourth biggest economy, is not in great health. And these are all the things that I think are going to be big issues and significant issues on the minds of Japanese electors. So I suspect they will punish the Liberal Democratic Party. It's just I'm not sure they're going to be able to punish them enough for them to lose. I mean, currently they've got 258 seats. You know, the closest next closest party is the Constitutional Democratic Party, and they've got 99 seats. So you're looking at quite a significant number of seats they need to make up. I was quite pleased to see that there's quite a lot of diversity in the Japanese parliament. You've got a Communist Party that has 10 seats. That's quite an interesting thing. Free education for all has, you know, they've currently got 4 seats. So yeah, look, I think traditionally the Japanese parliament has been quite pluralistic, and you know, you had many, many different parties being represented. But I can't see the liberal, the strong hold that they've got on power for the Liberal Democratic Party. I can't see that changing. And he's a well-known politician. He's, as Rodney said, had 5 shots at it, and it's finally his time. I think he'll give it a pretty good go.
And his father was a government minister as well, which isn't uncommon in these Japanese political dynasties.
Of course.
Speaking of dynasties, let's head over to the Pacific and to the US now, the election that everyone has its eyes on in 2024 as we record. Two gentlemen are preparing for a debate. That's JD Vance and Tim Walz, of course, the vice presidential nominees, I should say, for each party. Rodney, are you going to punish yourself and watch the VP debate?
Yeah, 100%. I could not, I'm afraid. So I'm pretty excited to watch this one.
Excited? Well, just
it'll be interesting.
Need more excitement in your life, mate.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Well, look, you know, last week we were talking about this, and you know, Trump was up in the Sun Belt states, and Harris was up in the Rust Belt, and you know, the polls have narrowed in some of those key swing states again. Further, some have flipped very marginally, but all within the margin of error, and so on. So these events can have an impact on voter intentions and so on. And given that there's not going, given it's too late to have another debate, as Trump said, and we are now having another debate, but with the vice presidential candidates, I'm afraid it's the last debate we're going to get of this election. So might as well take in the experience, and hopefully we'll see some fireworks.
Can anybody tell me whether they remember any part of the debate between Kamala Harris and Pence? Because I honestly can't. I can't believe how much hype there is around Tim Walz and JD Vance.
But this is the thing. I mean, vice president debates are usually not important at all. Like, no one usually cares.
Non-event.
It's a non-event because no one really cares about the vice president, right? Like, no, the contest in the US, because of the nature of the politics there, is between the two front runners, you know, the two presidential candidates. It's so interesting that this time round it is such a big deal. I mean, yeah, I really wonder why that is.
Well, I mean, you've got so much hype around it because let's be honest, we don't know much about those two, which is not, again, you're not supposed to know a lot about the VP candidates. But, you know, you look at the top of the ticket, you've got a person who's been in the headlines for the last 10 years. I mean, everyone knows about Trump. Kamala Harris, people are still trying to kind of figure out, etc. But it's almost like you've got 3 new players at this level. And Tim Walz, I mean, he's nobody knows who Tim Walz, or nobody really knew who Tim Walz was before he was rehearsing to become the VP pick. So I think there's a lot of curiosity. And also, as much as we all think it's ridiculous, some of the push by JD Vance on you know, people eating pets, etc., what he has managed to do is really create a name for himself. Now, I'm not sure how positive that name is, but he's certainly stolen a lot of oxygen from his presidential nominee. But he's really, really figured out how to kind of get into the headlines. I mean, I think it was last weekend he did every single Sunday show in terms of interview, did Meet the Press, and and MSNBC, Meet the Press, and I think CNN morning shows. So he is probably one of the best known and least liked, I think, VP candidates that we've had for a long time.
He's definitely not media shy. I'll give him that. And he does offer comment when a microphone's placed in front of him. So, I guess with the amount of oxygen that Trump absorbs, you have to work incredibly hard to have any sort of profile as his running mate. But you
he's
know,
done pretty well.
Yeah, he has done well. But you know, and we'll see how this debate goes. But last week we were talking about Mark Robinson and his issues and so on. It's all forgotten. Even eating pets seems to be a little bit in the past. You know, where Trump's moved on to in terms of suggesting that Kamala Harris is mentally impaired and so on. I mean, it's insane that this is where the election debate for the next president, or the election campaign or hype or discussion for the next president of the US sits. And perhaps the VP debate, and I say this without expectation and possibly more out of hope, might find itself a little bit more grounded in policy and reality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no doubt that how can you discuss policy with Trump or debate policy with Trump? At least on whatever you want about J.D. Vance, he does have a kind of intellectual grasp of the policies and a vision and whether you agree with it or not. You know, he has some sort of doctrine that he's following, you know, as much as he denies it. But a lot of the Project 2025 is you know, he could have written that. And Tim Walz, I'm not sure. Again, I think there's just a lot of curiosity around Tim Walz, and a lot of people are wanting to get to know him a bit better. But I think, you know, he's not an empty vessel when it comes to policy. I think he's done a pretty reasonable job implementing a lot of reforms as governor. So I think it's going to be interesting. Let's see.
Interesting indeed. And I just cannot believe the different topics that we just in 2 weeks of doing this new format on this podcast have been discussing, but such are the modern times that we live in. Who else would have thought we'd have two assassination attempts in one presidential campaign? But we'll continue to put things simply as much as possible on this podcast. Ozan and Rodney, good to see you again this week. See you next.
Thanks.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroku Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.